We have folks from both MPCA and DNR. If you guys want to introduce yourself, I understand you're going to kind of run together. Go ahead.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Smith. I'm the director of the Industrial Division at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
And I'm Larry Kramp. I'm the Assistant Commissioner at DNR that happens to also have the environmental review functions and lands and minerals underneath me at this time.
Shall we proceed? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the invitation today. We're going to talk a little bit about permitting and environmental review. As a way to introduce the conversation, I think I'd like to start by saying that we understand that there are concerns out there about states permitting and environmental review processes. We understand that we are an important piece of the economic recovery of the state, that the decisions we make in terms of permitting and environmental review impact jobs and economic growth. We've worked very hard over the last few years in particular to streamline our permitting and environment review processes, but we understand that there's more to do. And we look forward to working with you and our partners.
Excuse me. Yes. We'll bring the meeting to order. I've got the minutes before me from last Thursday. Has anybody looked at them? Representative Hansen.
I'll move the minutes from last Thursday.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Go ahead, Mr. Smith. You can continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We look forward to, I was going to finish my thought, we look forward to working with you and our external partners as we explore ways to continue to streamline the permitting and environmental review processes. Today we have a few basic things we want to cover. Kind of a primer for permitting environmental review. I think it's important as we explore ways to improve these processes that everyone have a common understanding about how the permitting and environmental review processes work. So we're going to do a little bit of that today. We're also going to share some information about the work we've done to streamline and improve these processes. We've got some results and some data to present to you. We'll then talk about how we set priorities at the PCA and the DNR and share some ideas about how that's going and how we all can interact to improve that. And then finally, Mr. Kramka will be adding some more detail as it pertains to the mining industry in Minnesota. Before I go any further, I thought I'd just flash up here the role of the MPCA, our mission. That is to work with Minnesotans to protect, conserve, and improve our environment and enhance our quality of life. In there is both the duty to provide environmental protection as well as to provide good and efficient regulatory services. We understand that, and I think as most of you understand, there's often a conflict between those two. Speed and effectiveness, efficiency and effectiveness sometimes do not go hand in hand. And as we're fond of saying over at the agency, usually if everybody's mad at us, that means we found the sweet spot in the regulation. A little bit about the permitting authority. I think it's important to understand that our authorities, the agency's authorities, come from federal programs. They're rooted in the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act of federal law. From those broader acts, the feds have a number of agencies. For us, the primary player is the Environmental Protection Agency, who write specific laws and pass those on down to the delegated states. Minnesota is a delegated state. To become one, we had to write our own laws that allowed us to accept those delegations. And for the most part, we are trying to line ourselves up with the feds and generally not trying to do anything more than what they are proposing to do and what's already written in federal regulation. I think it's important to understand that there's some benefits and some duties when it comes to being a delegated state. One of those responsibilities is that we can be We can be more stringent than federal law, but we can't be less stringent. So there is a ceiling that's set by federal regs that requires us to set some levels that every permit that we issue must comply with. There's some advantages to being a delegated state. One of those is that for our regulated communities, the alternative would be, if we were not, the regulated communities would be working directly with EPA Region 5 out of Chicago and with the headquarters in Washington. And for those of you that have worked with the feds, although I know there's some feeling like the PCA is challenging, working with the feds would be a much more daunting task, and it certainly would be a longer process. There's some additional benefits. Some of those include being able to write administrative requirements through state laws. We're also able to, through our legislative process, we're able to address specific issues raised by the regulated parties, by concerned citizens, and the courts. And we're also able to create some flexibility that otherwise would not be there. And finally, it's important to understand that where there's ambiguity in federal law, we're able to, through our rule writing process, add some clarity. And we believe all these things help Minnesota citizens and the regulated parties to understand what's required of them.
See, Mr. Director Smith, if I could just interject. Members, the thoughts are that both the MPCA, Director Smith is with, and Assistant Commissioner Cramp, will take about an hour to go through their presentation, and then we'll have time for questions after that. So you could just go ahead and roll through your whole presentation, and members will save their questions for the end, and hopefully some of them will get answered. But if they don't, we want to allow enough time for adequate questioning of both of you. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving on to the kinds of permits that the MPCA and the DNR are responsible for, we've got air emission permits. These cover things like fuel production, power plants, and so it's very large facilities as well as very small facilities. We issue permits that cover dry cleaners and garages and shops. On the wastewater side, these are water permits that cover, again, very large facilities. We've got the 300 million gallon per day metro wastewater treatment facility, and we've also got small wastewater treatment facilities that serve small neighborhoods of 10,000 gallons per day and above. So the range of wastewater facilities that are covered under the MPCA's permitting program is very vast. On the land side, we've got solid waste facilities covering landfills. We've got hazardous waste facilities that manage hazardous waste storage and processing, and we also have above ground storage tank permits that we issue. It's important also, I think, to understand that the land permits are preventative by nature. We don't want anything leaving those tanks, those hazardous waste facilities, while the air and wastewater permits are more about restricting the amount of pollution that's leaving these facilities to ensure that they are protecting the environment and human health. All told, between the MPC and the DNR, we have someplace around 15,000, 16,000, sometimes as high as 18,000 permits that the PCA and the DNR are in charge of being the administrators of. So we've got many, many permits and many facilities covered under our permitting process. Next, I'd like to touch on what goes into a permit. I think the main point in this slide is to understand that this is not a fishing license permit. This is not a local building permit. This is not a driver's license. This is a permit that's required and defined by federal regulation, and it must have some very critical pieces. One is the facility description. We must describe the owner operator of the plant. We must tell through this permit where it's located. We must describe what's happening at the facility. What are they making? What do they do? A wastewater treatment facility, XL Energy facility, power generation, et cetera, et cetera. And finally, we must describe in the permit what they're doing to treat their waste. We must describe their pollution control equipment. The next part of a permit covers effluent and emission limits. Our permits are required to describe the limits by which the facility will discharge to comply with federal law, state law. These are limits that are set to protect human health and the environment. So these are a critical piece. And finally, there's a reporting requirements section that describes and specifies and details the ways that these facilities will report back to the agency on how they're doing. And sometimes these are daily requirements, weekly, quarterly, and monthly and annually. So there's often a lot of reporting that comes back to the agency, and it's a way for us to evaluate how they're doing on a regular basis. And finally, we've got a section that we call boilerplate. It really is an effort to condense all the applicable federal and state regulations into a more manageable list of requirements. And it's for us, this is a key piece. If you've ever looked at the Code of Federal Regulation and the Minnesota rules lined up on a desk, it's longer than this. So our effort is to be able to condense these pieces down into a more manageable number. If you looked at permits from the PCA or the DNR, they can vary from a couple of pages long to a few dozen pages, depending on the type of the facility. You may ask, why are all these things required in a permit? And can it not be more like a fishing license or a driver's license or a building permit? And the answer is anchored in the idea that this is a public process. The federal process was meant to be open and transparent. It was meant to allow the public a chance to look at, review, and comment on permits. And so that's at the heart of the length of the permits and some of the requirements, is to understand it's not just an agreement between the regulated party and the regulated agency. It's an agreement between the public and the agencies and the regulated community. A little bit about the types of permits that we issue. One is the individual permit. That is one permit for one facility. These are typically the largest facilities, the most complicated, the most controversial, and in turn, that usually means that the permits we issue are the largest, the most complicated, and the most controversial. These are very technical documents. People often wonder why we have so many engineers and hydrologists and soil scientists working at the agency, and it is because it's our responsibility to make sure that these facilities and their treatment portions have a reasonable chance of operating and complying with the law. So we do a lot of review and back and forth when it comes to individual permits. Again, a key part of that individual permitting process is a 30-day public notice. As we move on to general permits, this is one permit that covers many facilities. You can imagine the benefits of this type of action. The public notice occurs before the permit's issued, and then a facility or group of facilities will apply to see if they qualify for that general permit. The advantages are that there is no individual permit public notice or no facility public notice. For the agency, that means that we can do one public notice, write one permit, and we can cover as few as a dozen facilities up to many thousands of facilities. And the benefit for the regulated community is that they get their permit sometimes in a couple days or a couple weeks. So the permit timeliness really goes down, and these are very speedy permits. In fact, these are so beneficial to the program, both in terms of the regulated parties and the regulating agencies, that we've got about 75% of our total permits are covered under general permits right now. A little bit about the permitting process. On this slide, the first step appears to be submit applications, but for individual permits, there's actually a step that happens before that, and that is the pre-application meetings or conversations. These we found over time to be very important, if not critical, especially when you're talking about the largest, most controversial permits. For us, this is a chance for us to, for the PCA staff to understand the scope of the project and to point out places where there might be some necessary or missing information. For the regulated party, it's a chance for them to hear about how the permitting process works and to tap into our 30 years of experience issuing many kinds of permits. So we really benefit from, and I think the regulated parties do too, and the benefits that usually show up in reduced timeliness at the back end of the process. So the real official first step is to submit applications. And then we begin the process of making sure that the application is complete. For general permits, simply it's an application indicating that they think they qualify for a general permit. And if they do, and we agree, then again, we issue that general permit within a couple days to a couple weeks. If it's an individual permit, there begins the process of understanding more about the details of their project. It can be and often is very technical. There's often a lot of evaluations, modeling required, monitoring required, and it becomes, a very technical conversation. In there is oftentimes an environmental review process, especially for those that trip those mandatory environmental review thresholds. I'll talk about those some more in just a bit. And then, of course, the public notice, which we've talked about before. There's a couple of additional steps that may or may not be taken, depending on the kind of permit that we're talking about. One is a public meeting. That usually occurs sometime in the middle of the public notice period. Oftentimes is at the request of the project proposer, or the PCA is recommending it, or a public meeting may be asked by the citizenry. We have found that these public meetings oftentimes, it's a chance for us to go out into the public where the facility is going to be built, along with the regulated parties, and have conversations and answer questions specific to those facilities. So it's a chance for us, if there are concerns, to answer those questions up front, and sometimes avoid confusion and the submission of comments during the public notice period that we'll have to address later. So we found this to be oftentimes a very useful tool. The other piece that may or may not be required is a conversation and presentation and decision by the MPCA Citizen Board. For those of you not familiar with the board, it is sort of an outlier in state government, but it's a 9-member board. The commissioner of the PCA leads that board, and there's 8 appointed citizens to the board, and they are appointed by the governor's office for a period of 4 years. Again, it may be asked of the agency by someone from the outside that we go to the board for a decision. We may decide as an agency along with the regulated party to that it's best that we go there and get a decision supporting the permit. But essentially it works the same way as a court decision, in that we go and make presentations and our board can ask questions. They can send us back if there's missing information, if they want some additional information. At the end of the day, though, they'll make a decision whether to approve issuance of a permit or deny. Okay, let's spend a little bit of time talking about environmental review. The Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, MEPA as it's called, was out in 1974 and has gone through many, many changes over the years. I can't think of a single governor that has not asked for or suggested that we explore how this process is working. It seems to be the point of a lot of consternation and concern. It certainly is a separate process. I think the important point here is it's a separate process from the permitting process. It happens independent of that piece and is meant to inform the permitting process. A key piece is that the environmental review is not administered by the MPCA or the DNR or the DOT or local units of government. There's a separate entity, the Environmental Quality Board, that's responsible for covering, writing the rules, and driving this piece of environmental review. The MPCA, the DNR, are merely responsible governmental units, and we are assigned projects depending on the type and the size of the project. The purpose of environmental review is to inform decision makers, the public, and the project proposers, also to disclose information about environmental effects and ways to minimize and avoid them. And it's a source of information to be integrated with the permitting process. It is not meant as an approval or disapproval process in terms of the permit. It's only meant to inform the conversations that go around a permit. The two typical forms of environmental review fall on environmental assessment worksheets, which are the more standard forms. These are used by all the RGUs, of which, again, the MPCA and the DNR are just a couple. There are 31 basic questions, and these questions range from things like land use, changes in truck traffic proposed by the project, crossing waterways, impacts to wildlife, very kind of basic questions covering environmental review and the project itself. The decision point for an EAW is whether there is potential for significant environmental impact. If the answer to that question is yes, then the project goes to the environmental impact statement for a more rigorous assessment. If the answer to that question is no, we can proceed to permitting with the understanding that comments received during the EAW process will be incorporated into permitting decisions. Moving on to the environmental impact statement, the EIS, again, it follows the EAW. It requires a more detailed analysis of the environmental impacts. It asks for an analysis of alternatives, including the no-build alternative, and it also asks for a more detailed analysis of the socioeconomic impacts. The decision point for the EIS is whether it's adequately covered those pieces. A little bit of information about environmental review. This graph shows all the project's environmental assessment worksheets, not EISs, this is just EAWs, in for the period of 2008 and 2009. So we had 208 total projects. I think the key message from here is an understanding of the total number of projects and how you can see the PCA in green and the DOT in purple and the DNR in blue over on the left-hand side of the graph. That is state government. The rest of those, so about 35% of the total projects were state government. We were the RGUs for those projects. The 65% remaining were all done by local units of government, townships, city and county offices, watershed districts, etc. For this period of time, 2008-2009, just a bit of information, there were 99 different RGUs, 3 state agencies and 96 non-state agencies that were the RGUs for projects. This graph is a little busy. I apologize for that. Our intent was not so that you could get down and read these in detail. It was just to show you the long list of the types of projects that are subject to environmental assessment worksheets. Again, as you look at the slide, the MPCA was responsible for those projects that are in green. And for us, there's basically just 4 types of projects that we're responsible for. That's wastewater treatment facilities, feedlots, fuel conversion facilities, and landfills. Moving on to process improvements. This is a word that we use around the agency is continuous improvement, or CI. We've always been concerned about trying to improve our processes. We've always been under pressure to issue permits faster and provide our regulatory services in a more timely and efficient manner. I would say since 2003, we've kind of beefed that up, and that was the result of having a commissioner that came from the private side and was well-versed in the Six Sigma tools for business and process improvement. We discovered through integrating those processes into our systems that, in fact, those tools could be used to improve government processes as well. So they are now part of our culture, and we use the same kind of methodology that folks use on the outside, the businesses use on the outside. We assess our process, gather input, collect and analyze data, understand current problems, and then improve our ways of doing work. And we understand that this is critical for us as we continue to try and explore and serve the needs of our customers. It's also been important as we learn how to use continuous improvement that we use all of the tools that are available. So beyond just Six Sigma, for those of you who are familiar with that particular set of tools, we're also using Lean and Kaizen events to help us, again, improve efficiency. I guess I might also mention back in 2003 when our commissioner came and was asking us to integrate continuous improvement throughout the agency, that we began knowing the need out there We began that analysis in our permitting programs, and every one of our permitting programs has gone through some level of process improvement. I think that's a great thing, and I think the results will show here shortly. Couple of things that we've done in the past. We've got many dozens of projects that we've undertaken over the last 8-9 years. I'm going to hit on just a couple here, the ones that we've completed and ones that we are working on right now. Low-risk permitting is just an idea that we batch certain types of similar projects. We assign those to certain permit writers, and they work statewide to drive these projects towards issuance. General permits, we've talked about the benefits of those. We continue to explore and look for additional places to build general permits. This year we reissued our general construction storm, our general industrial stormwater permit. A couple years back we issued a brand new general permit covering ballast water, and right now we're in the process of writing a general permit covering pesticide application. We understand as agencies that the world is moving on to the electronic world, and we're trying to keep pace with that. And one of the projects we just completed was the electronic submittal of discharge monitoring reports, or DMRs. Right now, or previous to this, DMRs were submitted in paper form. The PCA had to transfer that information from these paper forms into our database. This system allows us for the permittee to log into a portal on the agency's website and immediately download information electronically. It saves them time, and over the long run saves us time too, and cuts down on transcription errors. So this is a great thing. The rest of the projects here are also about exploring additional e-business tools. E-signatures are important. We know that is a wave of the future. We know that many people already use electronic tools to sign and submit information, and we need to be gearing up so that we are doing the same. We've got report and application submittals. This is an important piece, again, to try and maximize the use of electronic tools, getting data into our system as quickly as possible so that we can begin to analyze it and use it. And we also have a new state financial system, and we are exploring ways to make sure that payments for applications or reissuance fees can be done electronically. Again, we think this is a service that we need to provide to the regulated community in Minnesota. We've been trying to use this information. As many of you know, there last session there was a request from the legislators for the Office of Legislative Auditors to perform an audit on environmental permitting and environmental review. That was a statewide look, of which the PCA and the DNR are part of. We began to try to use these tools more efficiently, these electronic tools, to communicate with our the folks that were working with us from the auditor's office, and I think that's been very helpful. Although, one downfall is if the information is available electronically, you tend to ask for more of it. So the give and take and the conversations were probably more of a data swap that resulted in some delays, but better information being exchanged overall. Okay, on to the results of our work so far. Permit timeliness as an issue, a little bit of information here. I'll say first of all that our overall goal for permits within the agency, unless there's something more prescriptive, our overall goal has been for a few years now to issue 90% of the permits within 180 days. It is a goal we think is achievable. The 180 days is rooted in federal regulation, and it's also rooted in the MPC's current permitting process, in that right now you're required to submit an application for reissuance of a permit within 180 days. And our goal would be, our thought process was, if we could get those permits out within 180 days, the permit would never exceed its expiration date, and there would be no permit backlog. That's a good thing. So with that piece, it's under the idea that we've been working towards that goal for a number of years now. Here's some information about our air permits. 80% of the permits we issue in less than 150 days. We average 110 days. For water permits, 70% of the permits are issued in less than 180 days, average 130 days. For land permits, tanks, averaging 90 days. Hazardous waste, averaging 180 days. And landfills, averaging 365 days. some additional information. I'm not expecting you to read the details of this graph. Along the left side are average days to issue. Along the bottom are a breakout in the last 5 years. The important message of this slide is to show you the trend in the average days it takes us to issue permits. This is across all the media programs, air, feedlots, land, and wastewater. And then the black line begins at 205 days in average in 2005 and ends in 69 days average in 2009. So this is a great story showing that the process improvement efforts that we've done have been effective, and we are decreasing the time it takes us to issue permits. However, I will say again that we believe we can do more, and we're looking forward to working with you and our external partners on that issue. Finally, environmental review timeliness. Again, the colors aren't coming out in this black and white slide. They're not important for the conversation. Just to look at the trend, though, to look at the time it takes us to issue EAWs. These are both feedlots and EAWs as a group. So again, a nice trend going down. We're certainly much faster than we were in terms of issuing EAWs 10 years ago. For the period of 08 and 09, our shortest time to issue an EAW was 44 days, and the longest time was 652 days. Again, we believe there is room for improvement. Finally, before I turn over to Mr. Kramka, a little bit about priority permits and the ways we make decisions. Construction permits have been and will continue to be our number one priority. If I've got permit writers working on non-construction permits and a construction project comes in, we will assign staff to work on those as necessary. No question about it, that is an important piece, and it's probably even more important as we think about the economic times right now. With that said, I think there's a couple of misperceptions out there that I think we need to understand as we begin to explore what process improvement means in terms of timeliness. One of those is that I think there's a perception that we are failing all of Minnesota business. Our permitting process gets in the way of Minnesota businesses being able to perform, get their permits, and do their work. And I think that's it's unfortunate that that's the case, because as I've listed here, there's types of construction permits that we issue within a couple of weeks. And I draw your attention to the second bulleted point there. Right now we've got 3,500 air registration permits and general permits. We've got 3,500 facilities. These are businesses in Minnesota, mostly small, but still businesses. These are platers and dry cleaners and shops and bakeries that all are required to have a permit, that get their permit within a couple of weeks. So that's 3,500 facilities there that frankly, you guys never hear about. They never raise to the level of and make it to the ears of the legislators. But they are important permits for us, and we are supporting Minnesota business that way. Another example of that is our construction stormwater permits. We've got about 1,500 to 2,800 permits that we issue every year for the construction of facilities. These are supplying jobs to folks that are moving earth. They're eventually plumbers, electricians, and again, these are people that benefit, that have to have a permit, that benefit from timeliness. These particular construction stormwater permits are issued typically within 2 days of receiving a complete application. Again, very timely. I guess my point of this particular piece is to understand that for the most part, the projects that you hear about, the ones that raise to your level, are actually a very small number of facilities. And I think, and the reason I bring that up is because I think we need to focus our energies and our conversation on those construction pieces that are critical to people on the outside that are not being taken care of here. I'd hate to have us spend a lot of energy. The other misperception I think out there is that the state's permitting program as a whole is significantly broken. I hope from the data you've seen today and the work that we've done over the years that you have the feeling that for the most part, we issue most of the permits, a largest majority of the permits, very, very quickly and to the satisfaction of the regulated community and the citizens of Minnesota. My hope is that we can focus our attention down on those projects that are of the most importance to you, and these are typically also the largest, most controversial projects, and I think that's going to come out in our legislative audit report sometime here in the next couple of months. As a way to sort of explain this and add a little data to that particular piece, we went through an exercise this last fall of looking at permits that were over 150 days old, permits that had been at the PCA for greater than 150 days. So of the 15,000 or so, 16,000 permits that we're in charge of, doing the analysis, we discovered that we had 640 permits that were over 150 days old. That might sound like a lot, but then we began to parse that out, do a little more analysis on what those permits were, and began to ask the question, does anybody care about the issuance of most of these permits? And we discovered that most of these permits are standard reissuances, minor applications, that for the most part, no one cares about except for the PCA and EPA as we evaluate our processes. Businesses don't care about those. In fact, they prefer oftentimes that we not issue those because they often mean updated language and requirements, and there's nothing that they benefit from in terms of getting something they can continue to operate without having an updated permit. So as we began to parse down and tear apart this 640 facilities, we discovered that only 84 of these facilities were construction by nature. And by construction, I mean new facilities subject to significant change or modification, or also a permit decision was needed from the agency to describe what kind of permit, a decision was needed from the agency to describe what kind of permit was necessary for them to continue on with the next step of the project. I think those are the pieces, those particular facilities are the ones that you guys care about. Those are the ones that we're interested in working on with you. And I'm afraid that if we try to fix the whole ship, if we're going to try and rebuild the ship, we're going to spend a lot of extra energy and time when I think what's necessary is us to focus on a adjustment of a mast or so. And that's the piece that's important to us. And so we're excited to work with that and work with you on that piece. We believe there's less than probably a couple hundred of these in the system right now. And so I'm looking forward to having some more conversations about what that means. So with that long-winded explanation, I'll turn over to my colleague here.
Thank you, Director Smith. Commissioner Kramka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm focusing in today on the ones you never hear about. Metallic mining, the ones that everybody's happy with, the timeline. And want to just give you a little bit of perspective on where we've been, where we're going, some of the things that we've been learning over the last few years as we've been doing these projects related to environmental review. So as a means of kind of giving some background, I just want to walk through a few of the projects that we've seen since 2007, and I'm going to give you some dates that aren't on there so that you can put this into perspective. So ArcelorMittal was an expansion project on the East Reserve mining area. That was a joint federal-state EIS with the Corps of Engineers. That actually began with a scoping EAW, something that Jeff talked about earlier, in June of 2005, and was completed, as you can see there, in 2007. The Minnesota Steel EIS, a mine direct reduced iron plant and steel mill project, was again another joint federal state EIS with the Corps of Engineers. That began with a scoping EAW on July of 2005, and as you can see there, was completed in 2007 as well. The PolyMet North Met EIS, which you all are familiar with, began with a scoping EAW in June of 2005. That's a new non-ferrous mine, as you know, and processing facility on a brownfield in White Lakes. That also is a joint federal EIS with the Corps of Engineers, and more recently, as we've moved into a supplemental EIS process, the U.S. Forest Service, another federal agency, has joined in that project. The initial draft EIS was actually published in 2009. Moving forward, the U.S. Steel Keetac plant in Keewatin That project began with a scoping EAW in 2008, September of 2008, and was just completed in December of 2010. That's an expanded mine and the restart of a production line that has been idle for a number of years. That is also a joint federal state EIS with the Corps. Mesabi Nugget, this is their phase two project, which is reactivating two mine pits. That's also a joint federal state EIS with the Corps of Engineers. It was begun in July of 2008, and due to a number of site considerations, has not gotten to the point where we've been able to publish a draft at this time. That project continues to move forward as it's working through those site issues. The SR Steel supplemental EIS, this project has already undergone one environmental review, and due to their interest in changing their facilities moving forward, they moved into a supplemental EIS. This is the only one at this time that's actually a state-only EIS. There will not be any federal involvement in that project. It's expanding their furnace size and increasing some of their capacity there. That began in with a notice that we were going to prepare that supplemental EIS in March of 2010. So the required review, excuse me, both state and federal EISs are required under most of the mining projects that you see out there, and that's typically triggered by wetland and water resource impacts to the size of these projects, you know, cover thousands of acres typically, and in that part of the state it's very difficult to not encroach on wetlands or impact water resources, as many of you know. We typically develop joint federal state EISs so that the project can have a single document rather than a state process that's separate from the federal process, and having two ongoing public comment periods would add to confusion not only for the public but for the agencies trying to prepare those things. The federal NEPA review is required, with typically the state being a supplemental way of staffing and providing process framework for those two documents. When you marry the two of them together, it allows the state process to, in effect, kind of drive how the NEPA process plays out, because we have mechanisms where we can hire staffing that the federal government doesn't have. And so it helps move things along. The other thing that the Joint Environmental Review does is it increases some of the efficiencies, although I know many of you would probably hear from folks that it's not very efficient. The fact that we're able to concentrate all of the coordination efforts into a single project manager, the fact that we're able to take multiple lead agencies and bring them into a single process and scope not only each of those agencies' concerns but all of those multiple parts of each of those processes into a single unified process is helpful for everyone, including the project proposer. It also does, though, increase the complexity. As you can see the list there, there's a number of different things that come into play. For instance, on the PolyMet project, where you have now three joint lead agencies, both the Forest Service, the Corps of Engineers, and the DNR, just trying to keep track of what all of those different agencies' concerns are adds complexity. The two federal agencies don't have exactly the same way of doing environmental review, because NEPA actually allows each of the federal agencies to create their own process to comply with the law. So any federal agency that has a NEPA component to it, they have to satisfy basic concerns, but the way that they get there is very different. So if you're dealing with a HUD project or a Corps of Engineers project, you're going to see a very different set of documents and the way that they move through those processes. not something that most people know, because most people only deal with one agency and they think that's all there is just the one federal process that's out there. The other thing that comes into play in environmental review on these joint projects is the fact that the federal government is probably even more unable to staff the way that the state is to help manage these projects. They don't have a lot of environmental review staff that are assigned specifically to these things, and they don't have the expertise typically within their locales to deal with this. So oftentimes you're having to bring in parties from Washington, D.C. or West Coast or wherever they happen to be. And that's another area where you can lose time and cause additional cooperative problems just trying to work through those barriers. So what does the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act do to help NEPA? Typically, it provides the resources that the federal agencies lack, as I talked about earlier. We're able to assign a dedicated project manager that is just assigned to that project to manage herding all the cats and trying to get projects through to completion. We also have technical staff that are in-house and are typically assigned responsibilities that are you know, around the types of industries that Minnesota has. We know our mining situations here better than anybody else does, and we have the staff and expertise within the agencies to really manage those things. The other thing that we're able to do is hire an outside contractor to come in and assist in managing and drafting the document. We don't have in the agencies staff that are typically assigned to kind of wait for an EIS to come in and then write it. So what the agencies do is actually go out and hire that expertise, somebody who can take all of the data that comes in and turn that into an EIS document for us. Funding for those projects are done in the Minnesota statutes. The party that is proposing the project is required to pay. So when the state's doing this work and when our contractors are doing this work, the companies are paying for that service. The federal government's process for doing that kind of work is a little bit more difficult, and so it's one of those places where the state's able to actually help move the federal process along. The other thing that happens is that the federal process really does not have a timeline associated with it for completion. There is no minimum requirements on how long that the process can take, and there's no maximum. They have some requirements on how long they have to notice things, but they really don't have any other time constraints. So the state process, which has very detailed timing associated with it, allows us to at least move and try to influence how quickly the federal process moves along. So the major elements of an environmental impact statement, the first one is the proposed project description, and this is one of the things that is seems very simple. But this is really the guts of what goes into preparing an EIS. This really describes not only the size and scope of the project, but a lot of the project details, how big the furnaces are going to be, what they're going to be trying to create as far as outputs, all of that kind of stuff has to go into that project description, and it has to be detailed enough that it can then be turned into the various environmental studies that the EIS has to have as its back. It also has to outline what are the required permits and approvals that are expected for the project. It will also propose potential alternatives. Those are the kinds of things that you typically see as anything from the no build, meaning nothing happens or at least nothing new happens on the site, to the various ways about, you know, doing the mining, doing the processing, or the manufacturing. It has to describe the existing conditions of the site, any of the things that may be there regarding past land use practices and anything that's there going forward. And then from there, it also has to describe what the analysis of the environmental, social, and economic impacts are going to be. It has to lay out kind of the process by which the EIS is going to measure all of that stuff and decide whether there is an adequate decision at the end of the day. EIS preparation goes through those steps then of scoping, which on the state side, we use the EAW process to do that. By law, the scoping EAW, when you go directly to an EIS, this is different than the process that Jeff laid out. Many of these projects require an EIS by law, so right out of the gate we know that we're doing an EIS. We're not doing an EAW to decide whether or not an EIS is needed. We know an EIS is needed, and the process that the state uses then is that same EAW to go about basically deciding what needs to be in the EIS. The draft scoping decision document then is that tool that is laid out to the public that says this is what the responsible government unit believes needs to be covered in the EIS. There's a public meeting that is handled to go over that material and to allow then for the public to be informed on what all those intricate details are. There's the public comment period that comes along with that, so that's when the public is able to basically tell the responsible government units what they think is either missing, if there's anything that they think needs to be covered in different detail than is outlined by the agency, et cetera. There's then a final scoping decision, which is, okay, now we've gone through all of that process. The agency goes back and determines, was there anything missed? Is there something that needs to be added? That's added into that final scoping decision. If there's stuff that maybe wasn't deemed to be necessary, that could be taken out. But then that decision is published and people know what the final EIS is going to cover and how it's going to get there. On the federal side, there's just simply a federal notice of intent to prepare an EIS, and it basically looks very similar to that draft scoping decision document. It lays out that the federal government's going to do an EIS, who the agency is, how that process is going to go forward. Under normal conditions, a state EIS preparation notice would be done, and that would start a 280-day clock on preparation of an EIS. Now, if you remember when I said that these are joint federal agency responsibilities, since there is no maximum amount of time that a federal agency has to do an EIS, when you do a joint federal agency review, the project proposer in effect has to waive that 280 days because the federal process won't be bound by that 280 days. To move then to the study phase, basically we've taken all of that information now and developed what the EIS is going to look like, how it's going to be covered, and then you have to move into basically deciding how those studies are going to be done. This is, how are you going to assess the wetland impacts? How are the geochemistry characteristics of the project going to be affected? And develop those studies and then begin the work with the company providing that information through their consultants back to the responsible government units. The next step in the process would be a draft EIS preparation. That is prepared again by our consultants. The draft is reviewed by all of those different agencies before it can be published and making sure that everybody is comfortable that the document not only meets all of the intent and purpose of the law, but that it also meets what we said we were going to do in that scoping document and that the information within it is accurate and adequate. Once that's done through those cooperating agencies and the joint leads, the draft EIS is then published and put out on public review and comment period. That's done both through the EQB monitor on the state process side and the Federal Register for the federal side. And then that is also accompanied by a public information meeting where the elements and the components of that EIS are able to be presented to the public so that they can get their questions answered. If there are any confusions around what the document says or doesn't say, that's done at that public meeting, and then there is a public comment that follows that. After that public comment period is done and the comments are received, the agencies have to work through all of those comments and make sure that anything that is substantive is addressed, and that if there are further questions, that those things get answered as the final EIS is prepared. When the final EIS is completed, that's noticed again and published for the public. There is a shorter comment period for the state process, that 14 days. And the reason why that's a shorter process is that because the agencies have had now all of the benefit of that initial longer public comment period, it's really just about saying we're answering the comments that we received and we're making sure that there aren't any holes that are left over in the process. The federal comment period is by their rules 30 days. After that period, then there's the state adequacy determination. That is what just happened with KTAC in December. Is a decision document is signed by the responsible government unit that basically says the EIS followed all the rules, it went through all of the process, and it identified adequately all of the impacts and potential mitigations for the project, and that the document can be held as adequate in the public's eye. That then allows the agencies to move to permitting upon completion of that. With the federal side of things, you have a federal record of decision, and typically that also is accompanied by their final permit decision. So if you have a Corps of Engineers wetlands permit, for instance, the record of decision is typically at the same time that they're issuing their permit. And that comes sometime later. Because again, I'm gonna reiterate that the federal process and the timelines that they have are not the same as the state's. So what are the kinds of things that we've found as delays in the EIS process or potential delays in the EIS process? One of the things that is clear is that the joint federal state EIS, because you are trying to manage multiple agencies and multiple agencies' processes, it is more complex and typically then can add to delays. We think that in more recent times, we've gotten a much better handle on how the federal agencies that we typically work with on these projects operate and are able to much better control that delay potential in the joint federal EISs. But at any given time, we don't know where the federal agencies may have something that we didn't anticipate. So that's one place that we know is out there. Project complexity, a project that is basically something that we've seen before and we've done it many, many times, will likely be a much smoother and quicker process through the EISs than something that we haven't done before or that has lots of new technology or lots of new issues. So the KTAC process, for instance, that we just completed, a shorter time period because it is simply just an additional line to a taconite facility and an already functioning mine plant. We know how those operate. So the processes that were in play there were things that were known and we understood where we were heading much more quickly than on a PolyMet project where all of it is new. It is still, you know, an open pit mine like we've dealt with before, but we're dealing with very different complex issues around the geochemistry and the geology of that area. The other thing that we have found is that the project description is one of the things that is oftentimes not very well developed. When we start these projects, they really have to know how they're going to do their project, what they're going to do for their processing, and how they're going to build this thing at the end of the day. If you're in the process of still trying to formulate, working off of concepts or ideas, and you can't really lay out that you know that you have a process that's going to work, then your project description isn't going to be complete, and we're going to be building it as we go within an EIS. That means that you're going to have delays, because every time that you tweak or change a process and come up with a new project description, you have to start over, in some cases, much of the modeling and much of the work that's being done to assess the impacts of the project. Other places where technical studies would come into place as delays are that you have a lot of work that goes into developing what's the baseline data. If you don't have that data, you have to get it. That takes time. If you have to come to agreement on what the methodologies are around those studies and any of the assumptions that go into making those studies happen have to be understood and agreed to by all the parties. As you can imagine, again, the more complex the situation, the more difficult it is to come to the agreements on those assumptions. The other thing that happens oftentimes is that once you get into the results part of that, you get into the places where there's errors in the models. You have to go back and correct those things. The results may or may not actually turn out exactly like what you thought, and you have to then go back and figure out how to change the parameters in order to get a project that can be permitted or built. And then there's always the problem of scientific interpretation. Many of you have seen that before, where you can have three very capable and qualified engineers standing in the room, and all three of them having very different answers to the same data. The other thing that happens is we have new types of impacts that may be determined or come up within the process. Those are things that aren't necessarily anticipated, and then you have to determine what's those necessary mitigations that are going to be put into place. Those take time to work through. Again, the complexity of those projects comes into play. Another area where we have delay potential is just in the whole conflict management, communication, and coordination. As these projects become larger and larger, the number of people involved increases, and the number of public interests come into play. All of those things create the potentials for conflict. They create potentials for the inability to have communication working in both directions. I'll go back to my previous comment about, the scientists. We don't always talk in the same language, nor do we also always hear in the same language. And so many of these things are very complex and complicated, and being able to communicate them to that broad spectrum of people that are watching and looking at the project so that they understand what's going on can be very difficult sometimes. Project modifications, when a company decides, hey, they got a bright new idea halfway through the EIS, and they want to change entirely some segment of their project, that can be a real problem for the timelines, because all of the work that had been done prior to that was heading down a certain piping configuration, for instance, or something else, and they've now kind of decided to go a completely different direction, and the impacts now are going to be completely different, or could be. The other thing that we've also found in recent years is this changing regulations, policies, and procedures, especially in the air quality side of things, and I think Jeff would be able to speak to this. The environment around the regulations that are out there has been a very changing environment. Basically, throughout the last couple of years, I think we've had numerous places within EISs where we started out under one set of regulations, and halfway through there is a new set of regulations that we now have to try to manage, not only without a good understanding of what those regulations may or may not mean, but federal agencies that also don't have a full scope of what their regulation means either. They haven't even created the guidance in many cases to the agencies from Washington for them to implement in the local regional offices. Another thing, obviously, that comes into play is just the level of controversy around a project. The more controversy there is, the more opportunity there is for people to need more information, need longer periods for being able to read and comment on documents. All of those things can create additional delays in the process. And then the last thing is staffing. Typically, these projects require quite a bit of additional staff time, not only for the agencies, but for the companies. And what has been happening over the past probably 3-4 years, especially on the mining side, as mining has picked up globally, the experts that are actually even available out there has become thinner and thinner. And so being able to bring the people that you need to answer the questions, not only from the company side, but from the state side, into the game is becoming harder and harder. And that's just the function of, you know, there's only so many geochemists out there that are qualified to do this kind of work, or other scientists that are needed. So what are the things that DNR is finding as process improvement efforts? One of the things that we did and have been doing is looking at our own organizational structure. When the mining sector really picked up pace, we looked at how we were staffed and determined that we needed to do something different. And so the DNR, just like the PCA has done on their special projects side of things, we developed an environmental review side of our shop that was just dedicated to the mining sector. We had numerous EISs in play, and we needed to make sure that we had the expertise assigned to that that could manage and learn not only this federal process, but also manage these very complex projects moving forward. The other thing that we've done there is we've paired that up with other scientists within the agency. So we have hydrologists that are specifically assigned to the mining sector. We have other staff that are specifically assigned to these kinds of projects so that we can get them the attention that they need to keep them moving along and answering those questions that need to be answered. The other thing that we've done is we have really honed in on this idea of a complete project description. And many of the projects that are now coming online in the environmental review arena will very much benefit from being able to have a project description that truly identifies what they're going to do, and that they don't start down that path of doing studies and everything else before they get that. That we are actually able to make sure that when we start the EIS process, we know that we're at a place where the company and the state's ready to do an EIS. The stronger focus on satisfying the NEPA scoping procedures within the cooperating agencies is something that's also very critical. The NEPA process, as I told you before, is one that is different from agency to agency. We're learning much more and have learned a lot more about how to help the federal agencies do that part of their job within our environmental review process, and that's just by doing enough of these, we've learned that, and can benefit not only ourselves but the project proponents. And it actually, I think, also helps the public, because oftentimes it's very confusing for the public to understand what process they're in, whether it's the federal one or the state one, just as it's hard for them to understand when an EIS is going on, how permitting is happening at the same time. Lead agency collaboration with the proposer in the study designs. This is something that, again, we've made a very concerted effort to make sure that we have all of the right players in the room as we're trying to figure out what the study scope needs to be and how they're designed. The worst thing that could happen is a lead agency coming back 6 months into the project and saying, you should have done this part different. That's happened in the past, and we're making sure that that doesn't happen by making sure that we have agreements that are durable up front, that the scope of those design projects or those designed studies is agreed to, and that everybody is nodding their head at the end of the day so that we can move forward and not have further delays. We've created communications plans not only for the external parts of these projects, but also for the internal, to make sure that we know that everybody's getting the right information at the right time as it happens and as it's needed, and that the people who are communicating that are communicating it consistently, and that it's the same ones all the time doing that coordination back through the agency, so that we don't have some of these language problems, that we actually all know exactly what we're doing and how we're doing it. The last thing that I would say is that we have developed this format and consistent project management approach within the agency. This is something that we did not only for environmental review, but actually for our broader agency purposes as well. Using a well-known and well-understood project management format that everybody that is involved in any project within the agency understands the process and the language around that project management helps us to all stay on the same page and move us along quickly. So with that, I just want to say on behalf of Jeff and I, thank you very much for the opportunity again to try to bring you somewhat up to speed on something that's a very difficult subject, and one that we know you're going to have lots of questions going forward. We look forward to the ongoing discussion around how we can improve not only environmental review but permitting, and we'll stand for any questions, I guess, at this time.
Thank you, Commissioner Krampe. Questions at this time? We do have a list going, so questions for Assistant Commissioner Krampe or Director Smith. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's several things come to mind to talk about. Thank you for the fascinating presentation as we all try to get our arms around why Minnesota takes so much more time than surrounding states whose air is just as clean and water is just as clean as ours. But I understand it's a complicated process. I'd like to start with just a couple questions, Mr. Chair, if I may. The first one revolves around one that I find is personally irritating, and that's the whole business of silt fences. And I think one of your agencies promulgated rules that requires silt fencing around construction sites. And let me just preface my remarks with this comment that I just ran into yesterday, in fact, when a city official stopped me and said, hey, I see you're going to be visiting with PCA and DNR. Ask them where the Department of Common Sense is over there in this regard. We have a contractor that's ready to break ground as soon as he gets his permits issued on a construction project that will take less than 3 months. But he is required to either plow the entire construction site and put up silt fencing, which is going to require, I think, an ice auger to get the posts in the ground, or he can use those marvelous little beanbag kind of things that we have. But there's somewhere between 14 and 20 inches of snow on the site, and he's going to be done with the project before the ground even thaws. And yet he's required to put up silt fences. Now, when it comes to the average citizen looking over here and saying, is there any common sense at play in St. Paul, or why are we doing this? I guess that's one thing I want you to know, you're dealing with that perception out there. The other thing is just personally annoying. I'm thinking of a highway project that went by my house 15, 16 years ago. The orange silt fence is still up down in the storm ponds and along the bike trail that was constructed at some time later. There is a requirement to put them up. Is there a requirement to take them down, or do we just let them biodegrade? How's that work?
Director Smith?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am not well versed in the idea of the details of silt fencing. We certainly can get some responses to your question. I would assume that the process is to properly remove those silt fences after the project is completed. Yes.
Mr. Chair, one other thing. we're obviously not going to solve silt fences today, but I want to raise the issue to know that as somebody who interfaces with folks in the coffee shops in the community, these are the kind of feedback we get whenever we hear about citizens observing folks in the community that have to interact with you. Common sense is one thing that seems to be in short supply, and I'm just going to let you ruminate on that. and we may want to talk about it later, particularly now as it revolves around air permitting. I have a marvelous project in the district I represent that involves Coda Energy. It's a biomass generation facility that has had no end of heartache dealing with you folks in trying to get air permits for burning biomass, basically wheat and barley chaff. You don't have to tell me why the plow was dropped so deep on that project and why it took over 8 months beyond what the normal permitting process seemed to be, which delayed the operation, set back construction, and ran costs up. That's, I'm sure, something that's been addressed in the timelines you've talked about here. However, I have two concerns. One revolves around the fuel that they can burn, because in the district I represent, there's also a place called Canterbury Park that generates something neighborhood of 5 to 8 truckloads a week of biomass that we truck all the way to Benson, drives right by Rara Malt, Coda Energy, all the way to Benson, and they burn it in the turkey litter plant to generate electricity. They could save a lot of diesel fuel, a lot of wear and tear, and a lot of freight costs if they could burn it at the Coda Energy plant, but I understand that the air permit that they have is so strict that, and I don't know if it's considered experimental in the experimental phase or what it is, but those of us that are interested in seeing things like this actually prosper and flourish are concerned when good folks like Coda Energy can't even burn bedding material that comes from a mile and a half up the street in the facility that they're trying to run. By the way, they're short of biomass. They're looking for anything that they can burn, and one of the things that they've constantly notified me of is that the ability to burn alternative forms of biomass, for crying out loud, seems to be a problem that is generated right here at the MPCA. How do we get around that? And then whenever they do have an air emission quality program and self-report, we turn right around and slap them with a $45,000 fine because they're still tweaking their burning process. How does this all fit into streamlining the process, applying common sense, and actually trying to let Minnesota business prosper when they're trying to do the right thing?
Director Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, excellent questions, good examples of the impact of emerging technologies in a world where we are always looking towards the past to understand what the impacts might be for the future. This issue of burning biomass is one that has been kind of in the forefront and is developing over the last couple of years. We've learned quite a bit about permitting those particular facilities, and we've got some work ahead of us, absolutely. On the issue of trying to allow different fuels to be burned at biomass facilities, understand that when we began, we were really talking about a very finite kind of fuels. We're talking about corn stover, some particular sorts of waste materials from turkey litter, and over the last couple of years, it seems like it's changing, if not daily, certainly on a regular basis, where people are proposing to burn additional types of fuels that we had not heard of as a fuel source in the past. And that's exciting news. I think that means for us that there's opportunities for energy in places where it was purely waste in the past. In response to the idea that we're trying to adjust to that, one of the things that we have done as we talk about folks that are looking to burn additional fuels is to open up the permitting conversation early on so that we're not restricting the kind of fuels. Right now, as they come in and tell us in their applications, we want to burn these two things. We'll write into the permit, you're going to burn these two things. If they discover some additional source for fuel, we've had to go back in and major modify a permit. Oftentimes that results in a public notice period, and then we end up having conversations about those permits all over again. Our approach now, as it applies to different facilities burning different materials, is to look beyond just what they are proposing to burn right now and ask them the question, what else could you burn? What else would you want to burn? Because by doing so, we're allowed, for us that means we get to look at these particular fuel sources, understand how those potential air emissions might impact things on the lines of national ambient air quality standards, and then begin to address those things early and often so that we can get to what you're looking for right now, which is flexibility in fuel sources.
Just the last comment, no more, because I've got three or four other things we could go into here along the same lines, but you know, we've done it at Benson. We permitted Benson and the turkey litter. We permitted the St. Paul District Energy Plant, which burns all kinds of scrap woods and other stuff. This shouldn't have been totally brand new, but I think, and I'm learning here because it's the first time I've served on this element of the committee, it sounds like the boogeyman in the room is when you have to reopen a public comment period and start the whole clock winding down again. This sounds very expensive. Just my suggestion to the committee and to you folks would be, if we have good people doing the right thing, like we have with the folks at Coda Energy, and they're basically, it sounds to me like, a test lab where you're learning as much about this whole thing as they are, when they come up with a deviation from their permit because they tried a different combustion temperature, or maybe the barley malt was a little drier that they were burning, or whatever it was that caused them to come out of bounds, maybe we should say, well, we learned something, and send them a thank you note instead of sending them a fine and a citation. I don't understand where that incentivizes people to try to learn more and do the right thing and come outside the box as we try to move this whole thing ahead.
Representative Plum.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Smith, and Mr. Kremka, thank you for the presentation. And I like the trends, but I'm a little confused when the charts are showing short duration and all the EIS information was several years, but it doesn't stop when the permit's issued. In my district, we were impacted by the flood, and there were multiple permits issued for the cleaning up of debris from the flood. There was a hold put on after the permits were issued, and that prevented the work being completed before the snow and the frost. And now there's discussion, well, you need to improve stream beds a long duration beyond where there was any impact in this flood. And then with the recent pulling of a permit issued to a West Virginia mine, I'm wondering how frequent are the pulling of issued permits, and do you have some sort of report of why these are happening?
Director Smith?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm afraid I'm not familiar with the particular project that you're talking about. I'm aware that the flooding impacted southern Minnesota greatly, and I will absolutely check and follow up with you on those particular permits, if that's okay.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, there was a report by the PCA that just came out on air quality and the problems that the metropolitan area is going to probably run into on fine particulate matter, and it would probably be good for PCA to get that report to committee members. I don't know that all committee members have it. I just happened to receive it because it was at the end of the year and I was the committee chair then. So I think maybe that would be helpful. I have two different questions. Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, there have been proposals, or there is a proposal to cut state agency staffing by 15%. Would you expect that to have an impact on permitting processes?
I'd like to go first.
Commissioner Kremka. Mr. Chair and members, clearly most of the permitting staff that we have are covered by general fund dollars, and so impacts to our general fund over the past years have certainly put a stress on our ability to meet some of the demands that we have for both permitting and environmental review. The permitting that we do that's really going to be impacted is most likely in the arena of our waters permits. That's the part that is still predominantly general fund.
Director Smith, any comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I think the short answer to your question is as we consider cuts to the program, and the MPCA in general is funded primarily out of the environmental fund, not the general fund money, but cuts to that area certainly will have impacts to our permitting programs.
Representative Wiggin, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we were doing the budget, and this is for the PCA, when we were doing the budget 2 years ago, we were trying to determine if EISs and EAWs and permits were paid for by the permittee or paid for by somebody else. And what we found then was that for air permits, the folks who got them paid for them, and for hazardous waste permits, the folks who got them paid for them. But in the area of water permits, the folks who got them were not paying the full costs, and they were being subsidized by folks in my district and folks in the chair's district. So is that still the case?
Director Smith?
Mr. Chair, Representative, as you know, we went through a lengthy rule writing process to amend our fee rules last year, and it is our intent to be able to pay for our programs through the collection of fees. And I think what we found so far is that we didn't quite get it right, and there's some tweaking to be done to that system. But our intent is that the systems would pay for themselves, and they would do fairly across the media programs.
Representative Guinness.
Well, when we were looking at it 2 years ago, in the water area, the subsidies were in the millions of dollars, the range of millions and millions of dollars. And so it would be helpful to know what that level of subsidy is right now.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. One of the concerns I hear from businesses going through this process has to do with this whole idea of moving targets. When they apply for a permit and as they work through the system, things change. They have to meet different requirements as they move along through this process. Could you comment on that and tell us if that could be, once they apply, the requirements are set until they get that permit?
Or Director Smith?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's an excellent point, and one that we, as the state agency responsible for implementing federal standards, often struggle with. Especially on the air side, it seems like those federal regs are changing every day, and oftentimes we do not know when a decision will be coming down in terms of making the final recommendation. Oftentimes, especially the air regs adjust down, become more strict. There's, as you might imagine, a lot of public controversy, concern, comment on those regulations, and as such, it can turn into a lengthy public notice period, often resulting in lawsuits, and the result for the agency is that we strive to drive these projects forward, knowing what we know about the current activities, but with a mind towards the fact that there may be some decision behind us that's coming down from the EPA or the feds that may impact future programs. So it's always our decision to be to share information as soon as we have it with the regulated parties. If there's a decision that we know is coming, we often will contact the regulated communities through our mailing lists, electronic mailing lists, or give them a heads-up phone call to make sure that they understand how this may impact their project. But I think the short answer to your question is we are subject to the same sort of decisions and unknowns as projects develop.
Mr.
Chair, members, the other thing that I think oftentimes happens is back to this idea of what's the real project that you're going to build. And oftentimes, as that project changes through the process of them going through a permit, they make a change or a tweak to their project, something that wasn't anticipated in the original project now comes to light, and it feels as if, you know, the target's moved on the regulation. That's part of the reason why we think it's really critically important to have that project nailed down as tight as we can, so that we can kind of keep that that box that they're working in as small and as tight as possible.
Representative Dreskoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Smith and Mr. Krumka. I have three questions. One relates to the one Representative Wagenius raised, reductions in workforce. There are proposals out there to reduce the size of state government. As we know, our government has grown to be bigger than what the people of Minnesota can afford. You two gentlemen work for two different agencies and are part of that government. So my question is, first one, is what have you done or what are you doing to anticipate the need to reduce the size of the workforce, and especially as it relates to permitting, because that's what we're talking about today, and I expect that permitting is a significant portion of what your agencies do. The second one, and maybe it's really focused on Mr. Krumka, but maybe both of you, relates to what we heard in your presentation. Thank you both for your presentation, by the way, very informative. It seems and appears that there are some redundancies between the state and federal, both the permitting process and the EIS efforts to inform the permitting process. What can we do, and how can you help us develop legislation or policy that will help us maybe move to something where we can have one process? We do that, I know, in the area of meat inspection and some others. It would make common sense, again, to have one process rather than two, especially when, as I understand early in the presentation, that Minnesota and our MPCA is trying to follow as closely the federal guidelines as possible and not trying to create new ones. Third question would be around the interpretation of federal rules. I know I've worked, I'm in an agricultural community, I've worked with a lot of farmers. I was on a dairy farm this summer, and they were told that the MPCA was going to force them to place concrete impervious material all over their farmyard between their bunker silos on their farm, which just blew common sense out of the water. Talked with the MPCA, somebody in your agency, and they suggested that that was the interpretation that the agency received or made from the federal rules. So I'm questioning or curious about how those interpretations of federal rules are made, how our state rulemaking process works. Is that an area maybe that there's a lot of room for government and state government to go further than the federal government and maybe not have those checks? And I know one of the responses might be, well, we have these hearing processes. The reality is that farmer was never aware of those hearings, and most are not. So I'm sorry to present a complicated series of three questions, but I couldn't hold back.
Well, Representative Truskowski, that's quite a number of questions and could end up taking quite a bit of time. We have a number of people that have other questions. We'll give it a shot and try to keep it short, but we have a number of people. We probably won't get to everybody that has questions because we only have 10 minutes left of the committee. But who'd like to take it first? Commissioner Krumka?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll try to hit these really quickly. On the permitting side, I think the agencies have been doing a lot to look at not only how we can process things differently, with less staff or less resources available. We've been embarked on a number of years of developing general permits that make it so that people can basically do things with a permit, but they don't have to go through a lengthy process to get there. There's not a lot of paper that changes hands. There's not the same level of review of projects that you would have on something that requires the more lengthy permit process. I think that we've also been looking at our rules and trying to figure out, are we continuing to regulate the appropriate things? Are there things that we should not be regulating anymore? Those are the kinds of things that, you know, the agency should be doing, and we have been. As far as the redundancy on the process, I think the things that we've been trying to accomplish have been more administrative. The use of our project management system in order to kind of make sure that any places where there is redundancy within the environmental review process that it gets done once for both and not twice is in play, and we've been very successful in that. I think the problem that we have in the redundancy by itself is only a problem if we allow it to kind of run us down a bunch of different circles. if we can combine them into a single process like we have with the joint federal state EISs, then the redundancy is actually eliminated within that. It looks like it's on two sides of the ledger, but it's being done once and it's answering both sets of questions in a single fashion. If you try to eliminate it from the state side, one of the things that I talked about before is, at least from our perspective, and I know from some of the company's perspectives, the fact that we're in that mix with those federal agencies actually helps them get through it quicker. And so if you eliminate us from some of those questions that are common, there is the potential that you actually may add delay. And I'm not telling you that it's automatic, but it could happen. So you would want to be careful on how you do that.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to our testifiers this morning. I'm just wondering, Mr. Smith, this question goes to you. You had mentioned that you did an analysis of permits that were 150 days and out, and I'm just wondering how often you do those analysis, and then I have another question.
Director Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that particular one was probably the first time we've ever tried to pull across all of our data areas to understand that particular question. We do a lot of data analysis. We do a lot of running reports for the purposes of providing feedback for the specific sections that do permitting. So air permitting, water permitting, land permitting. Those are all different databases. They all have a different way of tracking and monitoring. And so in there is one of the difficulties that we have discovered that we think is a piece that we must become better at, and that is to look at our data systems across the media areas to understand these broader permitting impacts. So yes, the answer to your question is that was the first time we pulled across these data pieces to look and explore that 150-day question.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the next question I had was on the EIS preparation. It talks a little bit in here about the public, the period of public comment and that sort that subject. It doesn't really say how long that process is after the draft EIS public review, how long that process is and in that phase, and is there more than one, or can there be more than one comment phase to that?
Mr. Krampa?
Mr. Chair, members, you're taxing my brain a little bit here. The public comment period, there's several public comment periods along the way. Typically, the federal process actually is longer in most cases than the state required comment period, so it always defaults to the federal comment period anyway. And on any one of those spots, the public can ask for an extension or a longer period of time for those, which does occur periodically. It's typically asked for and granted when there is a highly complex thing that, you know, people need more time to understand it or digest it, or there's some ambiguity around some of the issues.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like you have to walk a tightrope here. You have to protect public health, protect the environment, and provide for business growth. And Representative Beard talked about new information with people wanting to do new things, and you've mentioned about your staff having scientific background, and science is always changing. We're getting new information, new papers published. I'd like to know a little bit about how your folks keep up with emerging technology, the science, so that they know that they're having the best available information to protect public health or protect the environment.
Mr. Krampa.
Mr. Chair, members, I can speak at least to a couple of different places, and this happens across a lot of the different disciplines that we have. But clearly on the mining side, there are a lot of technical conferences, classes, and you know, journals that are out there that our geochemists, our geologists are active in most of the societies that do that work, attending, you know, the cutting edge conferences on acid mine drainage, for instance, for waste disposal and all those kinds of things, keeping current Most of our scientists that have licenses obviously have to keep their licenses current by doing continuing education, and of course, we want them to keep their licenses current so they participate in those things.
Director Smith, any comment? Or?
No.
Okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you both for being here. My question is I was in Roseau and Kitson counties last week with the governor and Commissioner Landwehr, and we heard from local government officials up there about the arrogance involved in dealing with the people in the departments who are responsible for issuing permits. My question is this. Actually, I'd like an explanation, please. Mr. Smith, you said at the beginning of in your opening statement that you said that if everybody is mad at us, then we've found, I believe you said, the sweet spot. I'm concerned about that philosophy creating a culture within your departments that creates and leads to, in effect, the arrogance that our local government officials feel when dealing with those people. I'd like you to expand on that, please.
Sure. Director Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, first I apologize for the feeling that there's an arrogance associated with PCA staff. I've been working there for 20 years, and I can tell you, while I don't speak for every single person there as a group, it's a very concerned, interested, and engaged group of employees at the PCA, and I'll speak on behalf of the DNR staff as well. These are scientists, engineers, biologists, hydrologists, and with that is a natural curiosity as well as a desire to solve problems. It's also a very experienced group of staff, and in no way, shape, or form do we condone an arrogance, and I apologize for that feeling out there. I think one of the things that's important to understand about my comment about the sweet spot is just the tightrope that we seem to be always on, and there's always more we should do, must do, to provide efficient and timely regulatory services. And on the other side of that, we are always being looked at carefully and scrutinized in terms of our responsibility to protect the environment and human health. And oftentimes, as I said in my opening remark, it's a very difficult balance to achieve, and we feel the pressure of that, but believe that we oftentimes, more often than not, are able to find the spot that allows us to take care of both of those needs, not perfectly, but adequately. So we are always looking for the ways to provide both of those things.
Well, members, we've reached the end of our committee time. Representative Fabian has a follow-up question, and then I'll have a few more announcements. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Members, a few announcements that the chairman would like me to make for the rest of the week. Tomorrow we'll be hearing from Petter Larson. He'll be giving us a presentation on reforming environmental review. And we're going to hear from representatives from the mining and ethanol industries. We'll be hearing from the Office of the Legislative Auditor and MCEA tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we're going to hear the non-controversial lands bill that we did last year that we're going to do this year and get that going. The DNR has some issues that they have to get done with that, so we're going to get that passed out of here. I believe the Senate's going to be hearing that this week also. And then we'll be doing House File 1 on Thursday. So with that, members, meeting adjourned.